still before my failure, and carried the cross for my shame. My sin weighed upon your shoulders, my soul now to stand. So what could I say?
Dr. James Allen Francis once described Jesus with a powerful, in a very powerful way, and he said this about Jesus. He said he was born in an obscure village. He was the child of a peasant woman, and he grew up in another obscure village where he worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30 years old. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never went to college. He never visited a big city. He never traveled more than 200 miles from the place where he was born. He did none of the things that are usually associated with greatness, and he had no credentials but himself. He was only 33 when his friends ran away from him. One of them denied him. He was turned over to his enemies. He went through the mockery of a trial. He was nailed to a cross between two thieves. While dying, his executioners gambled for his clothing, which was the only property that he had on the earth. When he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave through the pity of a friend. And yet 20 centuries have come and gone, and today Jesus is the central figure of the human race. He is the leader of mankind's progress. All the armies that have ever marched, all the navies that have ever sailed, all the parliaments that have ever sat, all the kings that have ever reigned, put together, have not affected the life of mankind on earth as powerfully as that one solitary life. We understand this, that Jesus was no ordinary man. In fact, you can't really even say that he was an extraordinary man, because Jesus was in a class all by himself, and Jesus is in a class all by himself. Now, I want you to fall in love with Jesus, but I recognize that what Andy Stanley says is probably true. I can't make you fall in love with Jesus, but I hope that I can at least arrange a first date if you don't know him. And I hope to do that this morning through some of this conversation as we participate together in the scriptures and we look at this life and this ministry of Jesus Christ. And he was extraordinary in so many ways. He was definitely, first of all, no ordinary teacher, was he? He was no ordinary teacher. Consider how he taught. If you have your Bibles, turn to the book of Matthew in chapter 5, 6, and 7. This is the section of the Bible that is the most kind of compact and put together, where we have the greatest summary of Jesus' teachings and the things he says, and there's some great truth in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Now, I don't know if you've ever put that to memory. I know that at least four of us in this room have. I have, Dreema has, Debbie has, and Bob Casey has. I know that because all four of us at one point or another went through Lincoln Christian College and Seminary, sat in Dan Clymer's Life of Christ class, and had to memorize these three chapters of the Bible. Now, I can tell you that Bob only missed like 12 words out of all that. Debbie missed 8, and Dreema missed like 6. Your preacher missed several hundred, so we won't get into that. Nonetheless, I went to sleep with this on audio tape playing over and over and over in my head all night, the night before the test, thinking that would get me through it. And I still passed, but we'll leave it at that. But Jesus was no ordinary teacher. He said things that were absolutely extraordinary, and they confounded the people of Jesus' day. I mean, think about some of the things that he says here in the early going of the book of Matthew. He says things like, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." I mean, poor in spirit, that sounds like the word unhappy. And he says, blessed are the unhappy. That's unusual. People who heard that thought, what's he talking about? And blessed are those who mourn. That's not who we usually think of as blessed. And then he says these incredible things like, Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Now think about that for a moment. If you're a first century hearer of Jesus, I mean, who gets to have the earth? Well, that's what people were fighting over all the time. People still fight for who control what piece of real estate on the earth. It's all about power and prestige and who has the most might and the most strength or who has the most savvy and political structures. That's who, it's the earth, right? But Jesus, this itinerant preacher, comes along and he says, you know what? Do you know who's going to get the earth? It's not the power grabbers. It's the meek. It's the meek who get the earth. Man, people heard that and they thought, wow, what's this guy saying? I've never heard anything like that. Jesus was no ordinary teacher. He had a way of capturing the imagination of his hearers and drawing them in powerful, powerful ways. His teaching was revolutionary. It was turning things upside down. I mean, consider the parables that he teaches toward the end of this as you flip forward in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 7. And he told these parables, and we know that parables really at their core were earthly stories with heavenly meanings. And when Jesus told parables, and he told many, many parables, he told them in a way that just really drew people in. I mean, they would hear it and they'd get hooked by what he says. He tells one of his very first parables in the book of Matthew chapter 7, the 24th verse, and it says this. Jesus is giving his sermon. He comes to the conclusion, right? And I know you it's the part everyone, even if it's a good sermon, you want to hear the conclusion because usually the preacher saves his very best stuff for the end. Now, you'll have to see if I do that this morning or not now, right? But he saves his best punch for the end, and you want to hear that. You want to draw back in and hear it. And a lot of bad sermons have been saved by a great conclusion. But Jesus has preached an incredible sermon. He's given an incredible time of teaching, and he gets to the end, and this is his final story. A parable. And man, does it draw the listeners in. It says, Jesus said to them, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on a rock. The rains came down, the streams rose, and the wind blew and beat against the house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundations on the rock. Now, you got to remember, the first century doesn't have all of the architectural wonders that the 20th does. And they lived in an age where roof collapses and building collapses were common. When I was in Haiti and I shared this parable, this story there, I was amazed at how quickly it grabs hold of the people, because many people in Haiti, even today, because of the poor structure of their homes, when a hurricane comes and the storm comes, their houses collapse. It takes on a new meaning when you hear that story. But Jesus says that there's a man who is wise, and he builds his house on a solid foundation of rock so it can stand against the storm. And he says, but everyone who hears these words of mine and he does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who builds his house on the sand. The rain comes down, the streams rise, and winds blow and beat against that house, and it falls with a great crash. And it says that when the people heard his conclusion, boy, they were left thinking, boy, I'm going to take these words to heart. I'm going to be the wise man. I'm not going to be the foolish man. I'm going to be wise in what I do. I'm going to take these words and apply them to my life. And it says, the next verse, read what it says. It says, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching. They were amazed at his teaching. Do you know that phrase, amazed, shows up 27 times in the New Testament? 27 times it says people were amazed at what Jesus said or did. He was an amazing teacher. He was no ordinary teacher. He was absolutely unbelievable, incredible. The things that he said were amazing. He captured people's minds and their hearts and their spirits with his words. People wanted to follow Jesus. They were impressed by the things he said. He was no ordinary teacher. He was an extraordinary teacher. And Jesus was no ordinary king. He was no ordinary king. Now, I want you to grab some things that you already heard 2 weeks ago. You heard when we talked about the birth of Jesus, that when the wise men came, they said, we want to find him who's been born king of the Jews. Remember that? And at the end of his life, when he comes to the cross, Herod has them put a sign above his head that says, this is Jesus, king of the Jews. Now, he says it to mock him, but it says king of the Jews nonetheless, which was an apt descriptor of what he was. But you need to understand about Jesus that he was no ordinary king. The book of Luke gives us this interesting story in the 14th chapter about the kind of kingdom that Jesus was going to set up and who was going to be a part of his kingdom. It says this, he tells another story, and it is a description of the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom that Jesus hopes to set up. Jesus tells his host a story. He says, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or sisters or your relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed. This is who Jesus is reaching out to. He's going to be the king of the poor and the blind and the lame and the crippled. He says, this is going to be who's invited into his kingdom. I don't know, who do you invite to your parties? Who would you invite to your kingdom? Jesus invited those that the rest of society probably wouldn't have thought to invite. He said, my kingdom is open to everyone. My kingdom is, I'm inviting everyone into my party, so to speak. Jesus was a remarkable king. Chuck Colson says that in history, there are all kinds of kings and presidents and rulers and dictators who have led the people and have asked the people to lay down their life for their king. But Jesus was the first king to lay down his life for his subjects and for his people. He was no ordinary king. That is for certain. But the things about Jesus that made him not ordinary are also the things that made people struggle so much. I mean, you got to figure that in the first century context, the Jews were thought of by the Romans as somewhere between animals and slaves. And they desperately wanted a king, an earthly king. I mean, they had heard these prophecies about the Messiah. And in the prophecies, it seemed that there were two things that were always attributed to the coming Messiah: power and position. And that's what they wanted. And when they thought power and position, they thought politics. They thought a political solution to their problem. They thought Jesus was going to come and be this great political leader that would throw off the yoke of oppression of the Romans and reestablish Israel as this great nation like it had been under Solomon and David. That's what they wanted. That's what they thought was going to happen. And that's what they were looking for. We're going to look at the story in John 6 in a few minutes of the feeding of the 5,000. But you know, after that happened, after that event happens, the people come to Jesus. And Jesus, it says that Jesus saw they wanted to make him king by force. And so he withdrew. I mean, think about the events. The people are all excited. They're fired up. 5,000 people there. It's like a national convention. They're all excited about Jesus. They're saying, you want to petition Jesus? Just hand it out. We got enough signatures. We'll get it done. Or do you want an army to go in and throw a military coup? We've got it right now. We'll go overwhelm the leadership of our country. We'll take it over right now. We can do whatever you want, Jesus. You're our king. But that wasn't the model that Jesus was going after. That wasn't the nature of his kingdom. That wasn't what he was going to be about. And I think we need to learn something from that. I want us to understand something. I think that Christians should be involved in political process. I believe that. I mean, God has put you in a place where you have a chance to affect your government, and you should affect it. You should use your vote wisely. You should use it prayerfully. And just in the same way that you subject every other part of your life to the Lord, hopefully you subject your finances to the Lord. Hopefully you subject your lifestyle to the Lord's will. You should subject your vote to the Lord's will. You should prayerfully think about who I should vote for and why would I cast this vote. It should be something you think about. You should be involved in that. But having said that, I do not believe for a second that the solution for America's problems will be found through government. The ultimate solution to our problems are found through Christ and Christ alone. He is the solution to the world's problems today. I heard about a person who was advocating a write-in vote for Jesus Christ for president in the last election. I guess he got like 5,000 people to write in Jesus' name for president of the United States. A friend of mine asked that guy about it. He says, why would you do that? I think Jesus becoming president would be a demotion. I mean, he is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I don't think he wants to be president of a country. He's the King of all creation. What does he care about being a president for? He was no ordinary leader, and he had no ordinary kingdom. Jesus said some remarkable things about his kingdom and what it was going to be marked by. Jesus did some interesting things with his disciples. Recall when he sent them out two by two, he'd given them the following kinds of teachings about his kingdom to go out into the world. He had said things like, in my kingdom, we're going to love our enemies and pray for those who hate us. Teach that to people. In my kingdom, the first are going to be last, but the last are going to be first. In my kingdom, teach them to serve. Teach them to serve, because anyone that wants to become great has to become a servant. In my kingdom, we're going to go out, and I want you to care for those who are considered the least of these. In my kingdom, the citizens of my kingdom will put the needs of others ahead of their own needs. And in my kingdom, if you want to inherit the earth, you're meek. If you want to be exalted, you're humble. It's an upside-down kingdom. Some would hear that and think, oh, that's so naive. How could that kingdom ever work? Well, you have to put this juxtaposition or these two things side by side to understand something about the first century. Jesus is talking about this kingdom while Rome is the greatest empire the world has ever seen to that time and possibly ever in history. Rome's influence is felt all over the world. The kingdom of Rome is immense and massive. Everyone fears the Roman leaders. And everyone is subject in one way or another to the will of Rome. In the first century, these followers of Jesus, many will give their life as martyrs in the arena and other places at the will of Rome. It seemed there was no way that Rome could ever be overthrown, and what could the church possibly do to stand against such authority and power? But Jesus was advocating these simple things. And let me tell you, as I started my sermon this morning, Jesus did indeed change the world. So how did he do it? How did the people of his kingdom, because this is the question we have to ask ourselves. We've already seen it happen. We already saw a great empire completely changed by Christ's kingdom. How did it happen? Well, you know how it happened? The church just became the church. And they did what they were called to do. Think about this for a moment. In that first century, one of the things that happened in the first century was there was no respect for the sanctity of life. In fact, in their culture, if you had a child that was unwanted in the first century, you didn't go to a clinic. You just abandoned the baby on the side of the road. And it would naturally die. Still happens, unfortunately and sadly, in places around the world. You know what the church did? Christians went out and they picked up babies from the side of the road and took them in as their own, took on the responsibility for feeding them, caring for them and nurturing them. That was the church of the first century. In the first century, if your husband died, if you were going to survive, most women were forced to remarry whether they wanted to or not because it was the only way they could survive in their culture. But you know what the first century church did? They said, you know what? You don't have to be forced to remarry. You can come into the church and we'll help to take care of you and we'll provide for your needs. And they took care of the widows and the orphans by feeding them and housing them and caring for them. The first century church did things that were quite remarkable. The church changed the world by being the church. Let me ask you, what would happen today if the church was really the church? If we were adamantly out there caring for the sick in the way that they were in the first century, do you remember how much they cared for the church, for the sick and for those who were hurting? Do you remember how passionate they were about that? I mean, I recall the story where the four men ripped the ceiling apart to lower their friend down so they could see Jesus. They were passionate about caring for those that were injured, who were infirmed, who were sick. What would happen if the church was the church and we cared for the sick in the way they did in the first century, where they took in lepers, And they took in those outcasts that no one else wanted. I wonder, would there be a healthcare debate in our country today if the church was truly the church on the issue of caring for the sick? Or if the church was the church where marriage was honored in a culture where it wasn't? If marriage was honored and commitment was real, and there was a marked difference between those who were in the church and those who were in the world, and the divorce rate wasn't the same. In the first century, people were committed to their husband. They were committed to their wife. They had a deep, abiding commitment to their family. It was different from the rest of culture, which said, hey, it's okay to have sex with someone in the Roman bath, or it's okay to do this or to do that, as long as you preserve the idea of marriage. You can do anything you want. But not in the church. The church really held marriage up. It was held up as something that was different, that was pure, that was God-ordained. And it looked different. And wives in the first century who were used to being treated about like cattle found in the church husbands that honored their wives and put the needs of their wives ahead of themselves. It was revolutionary in the first century. Why, maybe it's revolutionary today. I wonder, would we have to ask the question, how do we define marriage today? If the church was really the church when it came to showing the world commitment and marriage. And I wonder what it would be like if the church was really the church when it came to caring for orphans and for foster children and for these people who are in trouble and for single moms. If we did those things like they did in the first century, what would happen to abortion rates in our country? And what if we really were the church? In the church of the first century, they shared things in common with another. They helped each other to be able to grow produce and to take care of themselves. And they taught people how to take care of themselves. What would happen? Global challenges and welfare rolls and global hunger if the church was really the church. I'll tell you what would happen if the church is really the church and God's kingdom is really God's kingdom and we live as though we are citizens of a king who thinks of the world in a whole different way. We would change our nation and our world the same way they changed their nation and theirs. And in the first century, the church seemed obscure and lacking in power. By the fourth century, the church had taken over the world. When the church is the church and God's kingdom is God's kingdom, we recognize that Jesus Christ was definitely no ordinary king. And finally, Jesus simply was no ordinary man. Many people today would make Jesus out to just be a good teacher, or to make him some political figure, or to make him just be a man and stripe him of his divinity. I'm not going to go through all the passages, but 34 different times Jesus performs miracles. We see his miraculous side, his divine nature is shown. Last week we talked about heaven itself opening up and God declaring him his own son. Jesus made these incredible statements like, if you've seen me, you have seen the Father. He didn't hide that he was divine, fully God, but he also didn't hide that he was fully human. And we have these passages where he's hungry and he's thirsty and he's sleeping. And sleepy, where he weeps with emotions, and we see where he dies. Jesus was no ordinary man. The last story I want to look at this morning is indeed from John chapter 6. It's a story about Jesus and his disciples. You know the story well. You read it this week. It's the feeding of the 5,000. I'm going to read through this story quickly this morning, but I want you to capture something. I want you to get your fingers ready because we're going to play a math game. To play this, you need to get to 7, or maybe I should say you need to get to 8. So if you can count that far, we're going to count and add up things as we go along. Numbers are important to this story. It says, sometime after Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing the sick. They knew he was no ordinary man. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside. He sat down with his disciples, for the Jewish Passover festival was near. When Jesus looked up and saw the great crowd coming toward him, he turned to Philip, one of his disciples, and he said, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" Now, Jesus asked this only to test Philip, for Jesus already had in his mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, because Philip was good at math. And Philip said real quickly in his head, there's always a person like this, right? There's always someone in the crowd who figures the cost up right away. They have that return on investment. I won't name who some of those people are here, but we have them here, right? I say, I want to do this new program. They say, oh, that's going to cost da-da-da-da. They know, right? They can figure it out real quick. I'm not that person, right? I mean, I may commit us to a million. I wouldn't commit us to a million, I don't think. I commit us to something sometimes. And say, whoa, that's going to cost a lot of money. Well, God's got the cattle on a thousand hills. I digress. Here we go. Philip does the math. He gets it real quick, and he says, it would take more than a half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one of these people to have even a single bite. Another one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, and he said, well, here is a boy with five small loaves and two small fish. Let's count them out. Five small loaves. One, two, three, four, five. Two small fish. Six, seven. Right? Seven. Keep that in our head, on our toes or our fingers, somewhere there. So he says seven. And I got to tell you, I think when he hears this, I think that Jesus is dying for them to ask him some questions about this. I think he wants them to come up with, well, how's this going to work? How's this going to happen? And so it says another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon's Peter, has spoke up. He finds the fish and the loaves. But how far will they go among so many? And I think Jesus wanted him to say, well, what do you have again? Count them up again. What do you have? And I get to see Peter or Andrew going, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Jesus says, no, how many do you have? What do you have to give the people? How much do you have? Tell me what you have to give the people. And he goes, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Don't you think Jesus was dying for someone to say, oh, wait a minute, we have eight. We have eight. Now we have five loaves, we have two fish, and we have Jesus. And if we have Jesus, we always have enough. Do you get that? If we have Jesus, we always have enough. And so what happens to the rest of the story you know well? Jesus begins to take the blood, the bread and the fish, and as they break them apart and they put them in baskets to distribute them, the miracle of multiplication begins to happen. And something truly extraordinary happens that day. For the disciples, I think they recognize the power of eight, or the power of nine, or the power of ten, whatever it is. It's whatever you think you have plus one that makes all the difference. Because Jesus is an ordinary. I mean, if I'm your friend, we'll sit down, we'll call the social service agencies, I'll look at the church benevolence fund, we'll do what we can, and I can help you a little bit. But, you know, I have a hard time stretching five loaves and two fish into enough to feed 5,000 people. I have a hard time with that. I don't have enough. You look at your budget sometimes, and you see the numbers, boy, this doesn't add up very good. There's not going to be enough. I don't like where this is headed. And you don't always understand how it's going to work. But you know what? If I take my best effort and I bring Jesus into it, I always find I have enough. And if you take your best effort and you bring Jesus to it, you'll find you have enough. And if we have a world that has all these problems, and they're big, I don't know how many problems we have, 10 million problems to deal with, maybe we just need to have 10 million problems and Jesus and we'll have enough. Because he's changed the world before and he wants to change the world again. But how's he going to do it? Well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s, he gave this address on the radio. You can think what you want to think about him as a president or a leader. He was a fallible human person, but he said something really wise one day. It was a Sunday night. It had been a really special day, and a day when the government had encouraged people to go to church. Can you believe that? The government had encouraged people across the country to attend church that Sunday. And that night he gave an address, a special address where he came together and he said this about what would change the world. Do you know what word he used, what he hoped for? Revival. Revival could change the world. That could happen again. Revival. I mean, It was a full-on reviving of God's people in the first century that changed the world. And the world today is ripe to be changed again. But it takes revival. Do you know what revival is at its core? Revival is when people begin to say, you know what? Jesus Christ is the most important thing in my life. Everything else is second to him. And people start to believe that. First one person believes it, then another, and then another. And you can't hardly, if that becomes center stone and paramount to your life, you got to share that with other people. So you start saying, I got to tell you about Jesus. He's the most important thing in my life. And it gets contagious. And when we put that happen, and when we make Jesus the center part of our life, and we say, I'm a citizen of his kingdom, and he's my king, and his kingdom comes, wow, incredible things happen. And if you don't think Jesus was about that, do you remember his prayer, his model prayer? He said, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And that is a prayer for revival. I pray that one will come, because you see, Jesus was no ordinary teacher, and he was no ordinary king, and he is no ordinary man. But with Jesus, everything else in our life can be overcome. If you don't know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, if you are living without his participation in your life, you are missing out. And I don't want you to miss out. I want you to have the richness of a relationship with Christ in your life. If you desire for Jesus Christ to be your Lord and Savior, will you come forward and make him such as we stand and we sing our invitation hymn?